So the talk is titled Sensory Awareness and Encountering Nature. And I really want to focus on just unpacking a little more deeply the work we're already doing, which is really coming to our senses, like Mary said. And we have such an amazing place to do that in. So I just want to kind of deepen this theme a little bit. And just to start with our lives, life is pretty simple here. But our modern 21st century life, well, we can just say it very simply. It's complicated. Our lives are complicated. And we want so much, and we get so much. I mean, we're materially the most wealthy culture that's ever existed on the face of the planet. We live in a culture now where you don't have to have a moment of distraction if you don't want it. You know, even in the gas pump now, there's TV, you know, giving you the latest sports update or the stock ticker or some celebrity gossip story, as if, God forbid, that one moment of nothing, you know, to distract your mind is going to kill you, you know? I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? So, you know, and we are fueling this with our desire, 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 desire. We want it all yesterday. So like Mary, I love to pluck out New Yorker cartoons. A lot of Dharma teachers have our own little private collection of cartoons. I can't read the who drew this cartoon. Twokey, it looks like. So I hope there's enough light for you to see. I'll pass it around. But a waiter very officiously is at a table, and there's a bear sitting there looking at the menu. And the bear says, I shouldn't, but I'm going to have the garbage. We love our desire. We want it all. And yet there's a way in which desire makes our life very complicated. We have so many things that we need to satisfy. And, you know, the Buddha said contentment is the greatest wealth. But that doesn't seem to be the motto of our culture. Having a lot of stuff seems to be our measure of wealth. But, you know, we get it. Oh, we're busy, we have complicated lives, and we meditate now, so, oh, we've learned a new trick. We've learned to be calm in the face of chaos. And so here's just a very great cartoon about that little. There's just a guy sitting on a porch, and it says, calm in the face of chaos. And it's just blank space and a vulture in the top. So there's nothing happening, but this dude is calm in the face of chaos. And we're fine with it being so complicated, multitasking this and multitasking that, and text and email and voicemail and, you know, chat this and chat that. I don't even do Facebook, but Facebook this, Twitter, you know, Instagram. I mean, I don't even do all this stuff, but we're fine. We're just calm with all that chaos, right? Not. Our lives are complicated. We make our relationships complicated. Again, the force of desire. Communication differences. a couple sitting at a table. They both look very cross. The man is saying to the woman, "I never said I love you. I said I love ya." Big difference. Again, a couple, male and female, very cross. And the man is talking to the woman, and she's got her back to him. And he's saying, "Of course I care about how you imagined, I thought you perceived, I wanted you to feel." Relationships are complicated. Family life is complicated. And then, you know, then we add to the whole mix the internet. And it gets us in situations like this. Mom and dad sitting down with their son. He looks about 10. And they're looking at him very sincerely and saying to him, "It's very important that you try very, very hard to remember where you electronically transferred mommy and daddy's assets." And then here's the tail really wagging the dog now. A happy little couple on the beach, holding hands, and one of them is saying to the other, "I can't wait to see what you're like online." So, I always think it's good to throw in humor on a retreat. We need it, don't we? Hopefully there's enough light to see all those. Life is complicated. So, on retreat, we try to make it very simple. And it's a hard adjustment, isn't it? I want to congratulate you. You're 2 days in, you know, from this kind of detox, from our digital diet and our busyness and our chaos and so many things to do and fix. And you know, a lot of it's really good, too. So, you know, our lives can feel full instead of busy. But, you know, often they feel just busy, busy. So we come on retreat and we quiet down. And it's really an adjustment to quiet down from all that stimulation. So if you've dealt with sleepiness, you know, that's a common experience. When our system is so used to being stimulated and suddenly all the stimulation's gone. So if sleepiness is happening, don't worry too much. You know, it tends to be there in the first day or two and tends to start lifting. You've put in 2 days, two solid days, you know, of really diligent effort. A lot of sitting, a lot of walking, and then sitting with your experience, you know, out of control. This thought comes, that thought comes, it boomerangs around. You know, we feel so happy with this memory, and then we feel really bummed out when we remember the unskillful thing we totally forgot we said, you know, as we were leaving home to head for the retreat. You know, that experience of getting ready for a retreat, I always call the storm before the calm. It's hard, isn't it, to get yourself ready. And here you are. We've embarked on this journey together 2 days in. So really, just no matter what's happened, how good or bad you feel this retreat is going, the fact of the matter is you showed up and you are showing up and you're putting in the effort. And over time, that effort really pays off. So feel good about your efforts so far. And again, it's not easy in the way our culture is training us to just sit down with ourselves just as we are. It's becoming, you know, a rarer and rarer skill. When we used to have idle time at the gas pump, idle time at the airport, you know, idle time waiting for somebody to pick us up with no phone to distract us, we got much more used to just letting ourselves be our own entertainment. So give yourself a lot of slack for the adjusting. And you've already done a lot of hard work. So it'll just keep paying off for you as the retreat develops. So my little theme of it's so complicated, I put it out there to contrast how grateful I am to the teachings of the Buddha, because he often just makes it so simple. And his very, very, very deep philosophy of how to free ourselves from suffering is very simple. It's called the Four Noble Truths. You know? Just four simple truths that free us, help us, point us down the path of being more free. He has the three feeling tones that I talked about when we were taking refuge, that we tend to only want the pleasant. But he said that, well, that's a little rough, since every experience is going to be colored not just, you know, by one possibility. There's three possibilities for any experience. Sometimes we hit the pleasant jackpot in the lottery, like a day like today, right? A week ago, the rain was so torrential, they had to, you know, figure out like how to shuttle in yogis to that first retreat of the season. So weather is very changeable here. But so far, so good, right? Fingers crossed. But the Buddha made it so simple. The human predicament is simply that we base all our happiness only on one of the three slices of the pie. And it's, that happiness is not reliable enough. It's not good enough for us. If what we really want is to be happy, then this life requires us to learn how to be happy when we have unpleasant experiences and how to be happy when we have neutral ones. But he made it so simple. He just boiled it down to that, the three feeling tones. So I'm really grateful for that. And now he made something else very simple. And he has a lot of numbered lists. In fact, there's a whole collection in the Pali Canon of suttas that are just called the numbered discourses. The twos, the threes, the fives, the eights, the sixes, the eightfold path, the seven factors of enlightenment, the six sense doors, the five aggregates, the four noble truths, the three feeling tones. I don't know what the two is. Is there a two? And that was even in stereo, just like two turtle doves. And then there's the not two, the oneness. So I want to focus on the number six. And he boiled down all of our life into something he called the all. And I'm going to read from the ancient texts. So it's, you know, it's an ancient vernacular. So just kind of bear with the language. You know, if the Buddha were alive today, I'm sure he'd be speaking in a way that we would really think was cool. But the way he taught back then, it doesn't sound so cool. Monks, I will teach you the all. Listen and pay close attention. What is the all? This is a big deal, right? Okay, the Buddha, fully enlightened guy. He's now going to describe the all, everything, the totality of experience. What is the all? Simply the eye and forms, ear and sounds, nose and aromas, tongue and flavors, body and tactile sensations, and intellect and ideas. This monk is called the all. Anyone who would say, repudiating this all, I will describe another, if questioned on what exactly might be the grounds for his statement, would be unable to explain, and furthermore, would be put to grief. Why? Because it lies beyond range. meaning you can't find anything outside of the six senses, the way the Buddha defines it. The all of our experience, the totality of our experience, is just six things. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And, am I leaving something out? Feeling? Yeah, the mind. Feeling is part of the mind. So he calls everything that isn't a physical sense, he puts it in, lumps it into one sense door, calling it mind, heart mind. Feelings, emotions, thoughts, that in the translation it was intellect and ideas. But we know mind is more than feelings and thoughts and ideas. It's awareness. It's memory. It's choosing. You know, there's a lot of things that go into mind. But it's all lumped as just one of the six sense doors. Extremely simple. Everything in your life is either coming through one of the five physical senses or is coming through the sixth sense door, the mind. In the mind, again, you know, it's a bunch of things, but essentially you can really boil it down into awareness and concepts. And then concepts can be broken down into abstract concepts and concrete concepts, right? You have the concept car, right? The car isn't an actual thing, it's an idea about a thing. The actual thing itself, we can only experience with our five senses. And just as we've been doing, we see that with the eyes, we see patches of color. But we know very quickly to put all those patches of color together into an object and call it car. But isn't it interesting? Our eye doesn't do that. The five physical senses don't do that. The sixth sense does, the mind. I remember really being struck in drawing class in high school, drawing a glass, and I didn't draw the glass at all with a pencil. Trying to make a glass look like a glass, I couldn't. There was no glass to draw. There was only color and shape. And mostly it was the reflections of other things in the glass. But when I really figured out how to draw those other things, like what the eye actually saw, then boom, it would sort of pop out as a glass. But that's not what my eye was doing that the hand had to imitate. So we see the world, like, you know, Mary was saying, very quickly we add this layer of the sixth sense and interpret what we're doing with the five sense doors. And she was trying to get at that, you know, in the morning's question and answer. We so quickly go out of our five physical senses into the sixth sense. And I think we would all agree on a percentage basis, if you're really, really in your senses, then you're probably only 94% up in your head. But if you're not very in your senses, you're really up, you know, a lot up in your head, then you're probably just 98%. So whoever we are massively loyal and invested in the sixth sense. We spend all of our time and energy there. But let's look at the sixth sense. So the abstract concepts, you know, freedom, justice, right? There's no concrete thing we can point to and say that's justice. You know, it's really an idea about an idea. Freedom, same thing. Car is a concrete concept. So our abstract concepts kind of are their own world, but all of our concrete concepts are, if I say the word car, notice what happens in your mind. You get an image, right? Yes? Just notice, what color is this car you're imagining? The mind, boom, it doesn't need any information. It's going to just put out a really clear picture right away. But most of what we're doing in this sixth sense is imagining something from the five senses. So I say car. Most of you probably got an image. Maybe did somebody hear a car? Did you hear the honk of a horn? Nobody? Everyone got image. But either way, it's representing one of the five senses. And then if you actually look at the abstract concepts, you know, something like if I say freedom, what comes into your mind? Do you get an image?
The word.
The word? Okay.
So, Richie Havens.
Richie Havens. And is there an image of Richie Havens, the singer?
Singing.
or so you're hearing it or seeing it?
I'm hearing it and
okay.
I'm seeing it.
So you're hearing it and seeing it. Well, I say the word freedom, and even then when it's abstract, we actually concretize it and make it concrete. So in either case, pretty much what we're doing almost all the time in the sixth sense is imagining something in the five senses. And so what we end up doing is being 98% loyal to fantasy and only 2% loyal to actual reality. Kind of a weird skew, isn't it? We are sitting here imagining seeing, imagining hearing, imagining smelling, tasting, and touching. And that's the world we would way rather live in than the five senses. It's just kind of weird. So this retreat is really an experiment in dropping out of the sixth sense and spending more time in our five senses, I almost said sentences, and see how that works for us. How's that working for you? You know, to have 98%-ish of your energy devoted to fantasy land. Like, that car that popped into your mind, it might be really sleek and cool and appealing, you know? But it's just a thought. It's all it is. We don't want to stop our mind from doing this because it's amazing. The thinking mind is an amazing thing that we can, like, symbolize reality and put thoughts together and, you know, take action based on that. It's miraculous. We're unique. So we're not trying to throw away thinking. But when we put 98% of our attention into this one sense door that is only imagining the other five, it often doesn't work very well for us. It's such a relief to check out of the five senses, check into the five senses, to drop out of the sixth sense and into your five senses. Now, there's one thing you can do, and let's just all do this together. Just for a minute, we'll just do a little bit of meditating. And I want you to imagine just dropping down into your body. So when you notice whatever sensations obvious in your body, you can kind of imagine me dropping down and being aware of the sensation in the sensation. Just drop down out of the head that yes, the head is part of the body, but just for now, drop out of the head and into a sensation in the body, preferably lower down, maybe belly or hands or legs. And just, it's kind of strange, kind of weird, but just imagine being down in the sensation, like you are the awareness that's noticing the sensation. And again, a little strange, but now kind of energetically glance upwards and notice, are there thoughts or images happening in the head area, behind the eyes or between the ears? Just notice. This little region between the ears, this little 6-inch space, is the ruler of your kingdom. Yet it doesn't have to be. We can drop into our body as one of the 5 physical sense experiences. And then we can get that, oh right, thinking and imaging tends to happen just in a part of me, just in this area, in the skull. The elbow's not churning out thoughts, the knee isn't churning out thoughts. We know it's our brain. But we can, when we notice that thoughts and images have happened in a location, we're already seeing through the belief we have that our thoughts are real and the only thing happening. When we can drop down like this into the body and sort of look up at the thoughts and images, then we get it. Oh, it's just my brain pumping out thoughts. The heart pumps blood. Brain pumps thoughts. And it's just a part of me. It's not all of me. And so now, if you would, open your eyes and tune into the meditation we were doing outside, being aware of seeing and hearing, and sensations in the body. Taking in patches of color. Hearing sounds. Noticing sensations arising. When we can drop out of the 6th sense and into the other 5, we often can have experiences of relief. Wow, that is busy up there in the head. Yeah, the body's got stuff going on, but it's not like yada, 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 you know? Like, when we identify less with our thinking mind and instead are aware of it, we learn some things. We learn that in our 5 physical senses, there is no time. When we're just seeing with eyes or hearing a sound, there isn't a past, present, or future. There's just this. Time only exists in our thoughts. If you think about it, where's yesterday? It's as gone as the dinosaurs. But we make it exist only as a thought. So it can exist as a thought. But as soon as Now let's switch and let's think about the future. Think about tomorrow. As soon as you switch out of the past, it's gone because it doesn't exist. You think about tomorrow and it's just as non-existent as yesterday. So past and future only exist as thoughts. They don't have real existence. And that's, you know, maybe obvious, but when we really get that, when you're really thinking about tomorrow and what's going to happen tomorrow, you can just say, oh, future thinking. It's just a bubble. And in that moment, that little bubble, it's like we prick it with a little pin, future thinking, and we can just let go. And that bubble's gone. The minute we're not giving that thought any power or energy, it has no staying power. So the thought world is very different from the real world. We switch thoughts, and the thing that was there in the thought world, a car, you know, is demolished, and it gets replaced by, you know, if I say grosbeak, maybe you'll picture the bird at the feeder, you know, with the green beak and the black and white wings and the yellow evening grosbeak. So as long as you're holding evening grosbeak in mind, that image is there. But then, boom, I say, think of basketball. Notice what color the basketball is. Now the grosbeak's gone. That's the thing about our thoughts. You know, even if a thought could be true, it's only true while you're thinking it. As soon as you let go of the thought, it can't be true because it doesn't even exist. So, all our trouble exists in the sixth sense. If you think about stress, stress is about past or future. And past and future don't exist. They only exist because we are relentlessly conjuring it up. And of course, we don't want to throw away the useful planning or the useful thinking about something we did that we can learn from. We wouldn't want to throw that out. But we want to get that a lot of our thinking just isn't really serving any purpose. It's just the brain on autopilot. So our stress is only existent in the sixth sense. Like Mary said, you know, pain is unavoidable, suffering is optional. Stuff happens, that's unavoidable. But stress is a response that we add. And this is not to poo-poo it, we all stress. You know, we have stressful lives. But this is to get that in any given moment, we do have some choice. Our attitude contributes so much to the situation. And we can just accept what is and do what we can do. And that's a non-stressful approach. Or we can really stress out and get really twitter-baited about whatever it is. But in any moment, we can say future thinking or past thinking. And actually, in that moment, we can drop the load. That's what's cool about getting that we're not our sixth sense. It's just a part of us that has a really important usefulness and purpose. But a lot of it is making us really unhappy in some ways. So the five senses correspond to actual things. The sixth sense just makes it up. And often our fantasy is a lot more drama than the reality. In Vipassana circles, we love to quote something Mark Twain said. The worst things in my life never happened. A spiritual teacher, Byron Katie, who you may know the work that she does. Anyway, I won't go into that too much. But she at a talk I heard her give once, had done some work with torture survivors, and to a person, the survivor said the worst thing was not the torture, it was the fear of it and the not knowing. Our mental imagining, you know, tends to usually be the worst part of an experience. So we can have a physical discomfort and our mind goes into kind of catastrophe thinking pretty easily, you know. And it's just a little bit of a sore knee at the end of your sit. And you've already got the appointment booked with the orthopedic surgeon, you know. We all do that. And then we don't realize that most of our stress is in our imagining what was going to become of the situation as opposed to the thing itself. So, but the really good news is we can wake up to that. And we can let go. Our thinking mind, those thoughts don't have any power if we don't give them the power. We can just let go. And so our retreat is this huge invitation to just let go, let go, let go, and drop into the five senses. You already know the sixth sense extremely well. We want to encourage you time and time again to check out what's happening with your other five. And this, remember, this is the all. Our physical five senses don't give us the trouble. An unpleasant sight is not suffering. An unpleasant sound is not suffering. Suffering is something we do in the sixth sense. We add to it. We basically don't want it to be there. And, you know, I'm setting the bar high. Of course, we're going to have reactions. But the point is, this practice can teach us more and more and more to replace reacting to something unpleasant. Replace the reaction with mindfulness and curiosity. Not, oh no, I can't believe this is happening, to, oh, what is this actually like? And that's the just golden switch that mindfulness practice encourages in us. So, to think of your experience just as one of the six senses, you know, it can be very grounding, very normalizing. Oh, it's just, you know, it's just hearing, or it's just the imagining of hearing. Oh, that's in the sixth sense. Oh, and there's thinking. Oh, so that's kind of there's sound in my head. I can listen to that thinking. And that thinking is imagining other senses. Oh, that's in the sixth sense. So it can help give us a little bit of observer perspective on our experience to realize everything you're doing is in one of these six sense doors. And then that kind of, it depersonalizes our experience. We take it less personally. It's six sense doors unfolding. And we believe the only one that's true is actually the only one that's false. The one we're really believing is the one that's fantasy, the sixth sense. So we want to come back and come to our senses, the actual five senses, and we de-stress immediately. The more we're in our body or sight or sound or smell or taste, the time element's taken out. There's just this. So just a little bit about, you know, the five senses themselves. If you would right now, just let your attention go into your right hand. And place your hand so that it's you know, spread out a little bit. And see if you can notice something in your pinky. Is there any sensation there in the pinky? Now see if you can notice something in the ring finger. Is any sensation in the middle finger? Index finger? Thumb? And now palm. And now take in the experience of the whole right hand, palm and fingers. Just notice. And now if you would notice, very likely you're creating an image of your right hand as you notice it. Notice the image. And then just go ahead and drop that. So, were the sensations changing or staying the same? They can increase, decrease, or fluctuate. Were they changing or staying the same?
Changing.
And then the image hand, was it stable or fluctuating?
Stable.
This tends to be what people experience. We experience the body as kind of a snap, crackle, pop of sensation. You've been working with the body today. You know, you've noticed that even if one sensation is kind of maybe a little bit stable, there's other things going on around it that are changing. And the more you start to notice sensation, the more change in them you notice. But since we're imagining the image hand, it's not an actual physical sense. It's coming through our sixth. We're imagining that. It can be stable in the mind. And our concepts and ideas about things, we say like, you know, it was a great run. We use the word a noun to describe something that was nothing but movement. Nothing but flow. Our concepts tend to be fixed, static. Your concept, the body, right, tends to be just a fixed idea, the image. Yet the actual experience is flow, change, increase, decrease, throb, pulse, you know, fluctuation. So right away, when we become aware of any of our sense doors, we see the difference between the actual physical sense experience and our interpretation of it. And let's be clear, it's very hard to do any of the five physical senses without the sixth sense getting intertwined. So we will image hand when we hear a bird sound. If we know the song, we'll picture the bird, or we'll just make up a bird. It doesn't really matter. So it's not like we're trying to say we shouldn't ever have the sixth sense happen, because it will. But we want to notice when we're mindful that there's a difference between the pure sound and the word bird or the image bird. We want to notice the difference between the pure sight, you know, of tan, brown, light brown, dark brown, and we're seeing all those little patches of color, and that's different from our mind saying ponderosa bark. Again, the concept, you know, ponderosa bark is just, it's very simple, but the actual visual experience is much more intricate. I mean, we just say tree for like the Buddha tree, right? If you look at that tree with your eyes, you could not ever get to the bottom of the detail of color in that tree. It is so many different things. But we just say tree, and then we move on. So, so the body is a good place to start noticing the difference between the actual experience and our idea. We will image, oh, there's a little throbbing in the knee. We'll image knee, but we want to actually feel more the throbbing. We don't want to fight the imaging. We just want to notice it and let our attention go just to the throbbing. You know, the sensations in our body, they do fit what the sixth sense knows about the body. We experience all this change in the body. Here's the scientific view of the body. 50 to 100 trillion cells make up our bodies. Over 50,000 of these cells will die and be replaced with new cells while you are listening to this sentence. Wow. The body makes new stomach lining every 5 days, a new liver every 6 weeks, replaces our hair in 2 to 5 years, our eyebrows every 3 to 5 months. We get new skin once a month and a new skeleton every 7 years. If you are your body, it means you are in constant flux. Which body are you? The one a moment ago or the one that will be 50,000 cells different a sentence from now? So, the body is the physical sense that nobody else can know. Our experience of our sensations, nobody can know our sensations, how our sensations actually feel. So in a way, it's the most private sense. Taste is a little bit similar. Nobody can know exactly how it is to taste the food in our mouth. They might have their own similar food, but we can never know, does it taste exactly the same to them as it does to us? Hard to know. We all have different taste buds. You know the cilantro thing? There's some gene, apparently, where something like 10% of people have it that makes cilantro taste like soap. Most of us love cilantro, but some of us hate it, right? So even taste is kind of a private thing. We don't really know what someone else's experience of it will be like. So switching to taste, Mary alluded to this, but most of our taste is actually smell. You may know this, but in case you don't, we really only taste 5 things. Sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and umami, or savory. I think I taste spicy, but maybe the food experts say, well, spice isn't so much of a flavor as it is just a, like, burning in your tongue. But 5 or 6, whatever, that's all the tongue does. The nose adds everything else. Very, very simple tongue. And, you know, taste is just an excuse to get you to eat some foods and not others. There's nothing intrinsic, right, about taste to the food. It's like the way our taste buds are developed. So birds, for instance, the chemical in taste that, you know, gives us the hot pepper feeling in the tongue is capsaicin. I think I'm pronouncing that right. And birds aren't affected by it at all. They can eat, you know, habaneros, like out the wazoo. The thought is evolutionarily that, you know, seeds are, fruit evolved as a seed dispersal mechanism. So when mammals eat peppers, apparently, they crunch the seeds with their teeth. And so peppers develop this defense against mammals. But birds don't really chew the fruit. They just swallow it. And then they fly away and they poop out the seeds. And so they take the seeds away from mom and dad and poop them out in a little pile of fertilizer. That's like the perfect seed dispensing machine. So somehow the way evolution happened is peppers evolved a defense against mammals, which destroy their seeds, but spared birds because birds proliferate the species. So taste is very non-objective. It's just a trick to get us to eat some things and avoid others. Smell. Go to smell. We've all, you know, we've all been in these senses a lot. I guess before I leave taste, you know, just when we're eating, I think it's really helpful to reflect that you're about to do the most intimate act of communion with the universe that we do. I mean, we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out CO2. That's one communion we do every day with plants, right? They breathe out oxygen and take up CO2. We breathe in oxygen and breathe out CO2. So we're very happy with plants, aren't we? That's intimate. But eating, you know, is just one step deeper. And if you think about it, you are really eating the entire universe whenever you sit down to eat. You know, the sun, the soil, the water, the air that went into the roots and leaves of the lettuce, then go into you. And so, you know, we're eating all of that. And then miraculously, it goes down our gullet. Now, you probably wouldn't say it's you yet, would you? If that lettuce is just, I'm going to be a little graphic here, if it's just sitting in your stomach, is it you yet? It's inside your body. It's right here. Stomach's right there. Is it you? I bet you would say no, because, you know, if you had to, you could puke it back out. But there it is, sitting inside you. Is it you, or is it the entire universe? Still, at what point, you know, maybe when it gets broken down even further and enters the small intestine, is it you yet? When does it become you? Isn't that weird? But literally, like, the thoughts you're thinking right now are because of the lettuce you ate that at some point became you. And we just think we're over here in our separate little me islands. And in fact, all we are is just everything else. We are what we eat. Or as one of my friends liked to joke, we are what we don't excrete. So, you probably wouldn't think all that stuff in your large intestine is you. Yet there it is in your body. Strange. So that is a way to encourage yourself to be mindful when you eat. It's like a prayer. You know, it's like amazing that we just are ingesting sun, soil, the air, and the water, and somehow, in some way, our digestive system turns it into us, whatever that means. And where do we stop and the universe start? I have no idea. So you can honor that incredible sacredness and intimacy with your mindfulness. It's worthy of paying attention to the universe becoming you. Okay. Whew. A lot more to get through. You know the other senses. And I really haven't mentioned hardly anything about nature yet. So I'll just kind of switch to that. So nature is like this calling. It's calling us to come out of sense door number 6 and be more curious about looking behind door number 1, door number 2, 3, 4, and 5. It's calling us. Can we hear the call? And it's calling us out of time and out of space, right? You might have experienced this. We're actually so limited in time and space. You know, we're only going to look at things for like a nanosecond. And God forbid, would we ever get down on our hands and knees, you know, and change our relationship to space and look at something really tiny. But when you start doing it, as we've done the last 2 days, it doesn't matter if you're looking at a vast landscape or just the little micro bark on a ponderosa. Our body is happy just using our senses. And so there's this huge sensory feast. outside of us. And we're so blessed to be in such a beautiful place. The sky, the clouds, the water, flowing water, the sounds of the hummingbirds trilling by. Again, it's a people whisperer, this world around us. And if we're willing, you know, to put some effort into our mindfulness, it's going to meet us, you know, with unexpected things. And then we do come into the peace of wild things, the more we get into our senses. And Wendell Berry, he just put it so simply and beautifully. I come into the peace of wild things. Okay, that's all five senses. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. That is all sense door number six. We tax our lives by anticipating grief. But we don't have to. That's the fantasy. Not to judge yourself for doing it, because we all do it in spades. But to get in a moment, there's a choice. Jack Kornfield and Ajahn Chah, a famous Thai teacher, were walking through the woods, and they see this big boulder, and Ajahn Chah says to Jack, "See that boulder? Do you think it's heavy?" Jack said, "Well, yeah, it's huge. Of course it's heavy." And Ajahn Chah said, "Not if you don't pick it up." He was talking about sense door number six. It's very heavy. Past and future weigh on us deeply. But our retreat is this invitation, is this experiment, you know, of 6 days of just again and again remembering to try the experiment and see if mindfulness alone can take care of you. Just be mindful of whatever whatever you're feeling. You don't know what to do, just be mindful. That's all. That's, and then there's always something to do. So I'll just close with a poem. It's called The Little Duck. A little bit more about wild things. And it's by Donald Babcock. And John Travis, the Vipassana teacher, dredged this up from The New Yorker in 1947. It was published in The New Yorker. The little duck. Now we're ready to look at something pretty special. It is a duck riding the ocean 100 feet beyond the surf. No, it isn't a gull. A gull always has a raucous touch about him. There is a great heaving in the Atlantic, and he is part of it. He looks a little like a mandarin, or the Lord Buddha meditating under the bow tree. Probably he doesn't know how large the ocean is, and neither do you. But he realizes it. And what does he do, I ask you? He sits down in it. He reposes in the immediate, as if it were infinity, which it is. That is religion, and the duck has it. He has made himself a part of the boundless by easing himself into it, just where it touches him. I like the little duck. He doesn't know much, but he's got religion. So let's sit for a minute.